KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Qualifying for a COVID-19 vaccine is a challenge for many Las Cruces residents. But getting the vaccination is much harder for those with mobility issues. As Madison Staten reports, the city's new homebound vaccination program is working to fill some of those gaps.
He said these three for sure, and then two from that list.
Las Cruces firefighters Ariel Caro and Matthew Castrahan aren't only distributing the COVID-19 vaccine. They're bringing hope to many of the city's most vulnerable residents.
That covers us from coast to coast.
Awesome. Congratulations.
The pair is part of a team assigned to the city's homebound vaccination program, targeting those who are not physically able to travel to a vaccination site. Firefighter Ariel Caro says she's thankful for the opportunity to serve.
They love that we're helping out, going to their house and making their life and their loved ones' life like a little easier for them. I'm glad that the fire department is a part of this program and the ones that are like sponsoring the program, just so that way people can see that we're here for them.
City Interim Deputy Chief Justin Allen says the program is hoping to distribute 90 vaccines a week. They're currently targeting a specific group identified through city programs: Las Cruces residents who are homebound due to illness, injury, or other circumstances.
We're utilizing our senior programs and quality of life department within the city of Las Cruces. We're utilizing them and using a list that they have for their Meals on Wheels and several other homebound initiatives that they have and programs. Currently, we're at least 650 plus homebound individuals that we've identified.
Many of those identified through city programs did not register for the COVID-19 vaccine themselves, relying on registration events or friends and family members. Caro outlined how firefighters can pull up a confirmation code on site to document that the vaccine was distributed correctly.
Some people don't have access to cell phones. They don't have access to a computer. All they have is just a flip phone. So I go ahead and put them into the system on the Department of Health website and just register them so I can give them a confirmation number, and just so that it's documented they got their vaccine.
Las Cruces City Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvi chairs both the city's COVID-19 Vaccination Task Force and the Health Policy Review Committee. She highlighted how the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is vital for the homebound vaccination program because it requires only one dose.
When we do have individuals that are in high-risk populations, sometimes it can be harder to see them again for that second time, and there is a timing issue with our Pfizer and Moderna. You need to get that second shot within a time frame. And so just having the Johnson & Johnson makes that process much more smoother and allows us at the city to be able to reach more people as well for that full vaccination.
Beda-Stuvi emphasized that a lack of resources should not prohibit members of the community from being vaccinated.
There are many people, they just don't have that access to be able to go out and get the vaccine. Even mobility is such an issue for a lot of these individuals. And so by us reaching out to them, we're able to care for them as well in these different capacities and make sure that they stay safe and healthy.
For City Interim Deputy Chief Justin Allen, it's about serving those who might not otherwise have an opportunity for vaccination.
Everybody, I think, realizes the safety measures that needed to be taken with the COVID-19. So it's important for us to be able to go out and reach them and show that they're still going to be able to receive the same amount of treatment that everybody else is.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Las Cruces residents wondering if they qualify for the homebound vaccination program may contact the city. The number is 575-528-5119. That's 528-5119. You may also click on the homebound vaccination icon if you register for the vaccine online. You will find a link to vaccine registration on our homepage at krwg.org. And Madison Staten will be back later in the program. She went to the Las Cruces City Council this week, and the City Council was talking about trying to increase the number of vaccinations distributed in the Las Cruces area. Well, it has been a year since the U.S. and Mexico closed the border to all non-essential travel. The pandemic restrictions have underscored the importance of informal workers who go back and forth. It's something many border residents don't talk about openly as they adapt to a new reality. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports from El Paso.
When the border abruptly closed a year ago to non-essential travel, it disrupted daily life on both sides, cutting off families in El Paso from the workers they depend on in Juarez.
We were quickly trying to scramble and figure out what can we do next, what are our other options.
Patricia is a single mother of three in El Paso. We're not using her full name because the woman her family hired to help her grandmother was not authorized to work in the U.S. Before the border shutdown, Mexican citizens would enter the country with a legal document, a border crossing card, to visit family, friends, and shop, but it's not a work permit. The fact that many would work while on the U.S. side of the border was an open secret.
I do have a lot of people that I know that depend on workers coming from Mexico for different reasons, whether it be for, you know, care of an elderly person, care for children, you know, for home care.
Her grandmother is disabled and has diabetes and relied on a caregiver from Juarez.
We did have a lady come to El Paso every week, Sunday to Friday, and she would care for my grandmother full time. Day and night, which was very helpful because the entire family has full-time jobs. You know, they go to school and lots of commitments, and we wanted to be sure that our grandmother was taken care of.
This affordable support system is vital for women in the U.S. who hold down jobs outside the home. At the same time, the income earned by women from Mexico helps support their families. These essential workers helping other essential workers are mostly women doing
caring work or caring labor.
Joe Hyman is director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies at the University of Texas at El Paso. He says informal work arrangements happen all along the U.S.-Mexico border. That hidden labor force was cut off because pandemic restrictions limited border crossings to essential reasons.
I think essential was very much in the eye of the beholder. I think when we go to figure out who is essential, we're going to find it's a very insightful map of power.
It's made it very hard, says Catalina, who has not crossed the border in a year. We're not using her full name because she was not authorized to work. She cleaned homes and did laundry in El Paso 4 days a week, mostly for older people. Her husband has a full-time job in Juarez, but they relied on a dual income to support their family. She's not alone.
Amigas y hermanas que...
She says she has friends and sisters who depended on going to work in El Paso. All are eagerly waiting for the border to reopen.
I can't wait for it to happen either.
Patricia in El Paso has not been able to find a reliable, affordable alternative for her grandmother who needs round-the-clock care.
The cost is just outrageous, you know, to care for, to hire somebody from a healthcare agency, even to come for 3 hours, it can range anywhere between $30 to $50 an hour.
The pandemic travel restrictions created economic hardship on both sides of the border, but did not break the strong bonds between many of the workers in Mexico and the families on the U.S. side who depend on them.
We have continued to help, you know, this woman that will come and care for my grandmother. She's just become like family to us.
They take groceries and used items to Juarez so she can sell them for a little cash. And Catalina, another informal worker living in Juarez, is also getting help from one of her employers in El Paso.
Muy buenas que me encontré en el camino. Que Diosito me las puso ahí.
She says God put some very good people in her path. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
The recent blackouts in Texas caused big problems in that state and have resulted in higher natural gas costs in New Mexico and elsewhere. As Mose Bushell reports, a recent House committee hearing looked at the problems and possible solutions.
Experts talked about improving transmission lines and making infrastructure more resilient, among other things. Beth Garza is with the R Street Institute, a policy think tank. She said with enough investment, the technology exists to keep most blackouts from hitting huge chunks of the population for extended periods of time.
it seems like we could manage the reactions or the response in a much more granular and a much more targeted level than we're able to do now.
Texas is the only state with its own independent grid. Members of the committee also heard about connecting it to other U.S. grids as a safeguard. So far, there has been very little appetite among Texas state lawmakers to consider that option. I'm Mose Bouchel in Austin.
And we'll continue to cover that story. A lot more wrangling to go about the fallout in Texas over the big freeze and the resulting blackouts that caused billions of dollars in damage to homes, businesses, schools, and much more. Well, legislation to reduce voting access in Texas is taking heat in both the state House and the Senate this session, as Houston Public Media's Haya Panwani reports. The political advocacy group Move Texas has launched an opposition campaign.
Among the proposed laws, one would make it a felony to encourage and issue absentee ballots to anyone who didn't request one. Two would require countywide polling places to have the same number of voting machines despite population variations. And three would charge volunteers who encourage people to get out the vote. Charlie Bonner is with Move Texas.
Instead of focusing on storm recovery and the millions of Texans that went without power or water, or focusing on suppressing the virus, these folks are committed to suppressing the vote.
Senate Bill 7 and House Bill 6 were submitted on the filing deadline for this legislative session. I'm Haya Panjwani in Houston.
Moving to Washington politics now, where Democrats are pushing various immigration reforms in Congress. Bills giving millions of immigrants a path to citizenship are now heading to the U.S. Senate for approval after passing in the House. Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro says the American Dream and Promise Act includes help for young dreamers brought illegally to the U.S. as kids.
And then another group is farm workers. So the Farm Workforce Modernization Act would, in essence, give farm workers a path to citizenship.
New Mexico 2nd District Congresswoman Yvette Harrell joined fellow Republicans in voting against the bills. Castro says Congress is currently working with the White House to make sure these and other immigration legislation makes it over the finish line. That is very much in doubt, as many members of the GOP are working against immigration reform. But one of the nation's most prominent members of the Republican Party says that his party must take a different approach. Former President George W. Bush says he is deeply concerned by the rhetoric he's been hearing lately surrounding immigration from fellow Republicans. He is releasing a book next month called Out of Many, One: Portraits of America's Immigrants.
And so I thought it was appropriate to basically say to American people, let's refocus our attention on immigration in a way that understands the contributions immigrants make to our society.
Bush spoke to the Texas Tribune as part of the South by Southwest Film Festival. Back to local politics now, and the Las Cruces City Council received an update on COVID-19 vaccine allocation this week. The council also reviewed the city's proposed 2021 to 2025 consolidated plan. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
In an update on COVID-19 vaccination efforts to the Las Cruces City Council, Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvi reported that 31.8% of Doña Ana County residents have received at least one dose of the vaccine. It's something she attributes in part to an increase in the weekly number of vaccines from the state, which have more than doubled since the beginning of February.
It's been about an 82% increase. In terms of rankings, we have not still moved as far as I think we should. Our report out last week was our ranking on how many vaccines we've distributed per population per county. We were at the bottom fourth, now we're at the bottom eighth. So we've moved up a little bit.
Although almost 50% of those within the county have registered for the vaccine, it will not be enough to achieve herd immunity. Dr. Anthony Fauci,
the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, estimates that 70 to 90% of the population will have to be vaccinated in order for herd immunity to be achieved. Las Cruces Mayor Ken Miyagashima expressed concern that the number of vaccines available could begin to outweigh the number of people registered to receive it.
What's concerning me a little bit is it's moving along quite well. We've made some pretty good strides in the last couple of weeks. And if it continues, we're going to be getting into the 40s. And unless we increase the amount registered, then we're going to run out of people to inoculate.
In order to combat the issue, the city's COVID-19 vaccination task force is working on a media awareness campaign detailing how to register for the vaccine. The council also reviewed the city's proposed 2021 through 2025 consolidated plan, seeking to expand affordable housing options, improve access to health and safety programs, and reduce homelessness within Las Cruces. Consultant Caitlin Michaud presented the plan to the council. She outlined the potential strategies to increase health and safety program access.
Increase awareness about available services in the community, you know, provide free or low-cost services to qualified individuals, increasing capacity and access to case management. Another COVID-specific impact, because of the pandemic, we are seeing a need for increased mental health services and support for isolated seniors and others in the community.
On the matter of housing, Councillor Cassandra Gondara stressed the importance of home rehabilitation in order to curb gentrification within the city.
There are so many people very concerned about gentrification. One of the priorities for me would be that home rehabilitation, you know, continue to upgrade these folks' homes, and maybe a rent-to-own program, I think would be really important so that we can mitigate gentrification.
Councillor Ioana Bencomo says she's excited for the final consolidated plan to be put before the council later this spring.
Often I feel like our role is to try to get rid of these impediments, more systemic changes so that people can operate more freely to be able to do the work they need to when we're serving our community in terms of housing.
Public comment on the plan is currently open and will continue until April 15th. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And if you ever miss Madison's reports on the Las Cruces City Council or other issues, no worries, we have you covered. They're on demand anytime at the region's homepage, krwg.org. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. A year ago, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces, and every week we are presenting portions of those interviews. Today, the conversation is with Vietnam veteran Timothy Kane. It's facilitated by StoryCorps' Luigi Villanueva.
Washington, D.C. is my birthplace, but I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland, immediately north of D.C. Interesting times. This is 1941. It's unbelievable that on my parents' deed, it says they could not sell their house to a person of the Jewish religion or African-American descent. The local record stores would not sell a black artist. And this is Maryland, north of D.C. You would think it'd be progressive or not so racist. But fortunately, I went to high school in D.C., and a significant part of the class was black. The number one and number two guys in my class were black. So it really did have an influence, in my opinion, about all this nonsense. Mm-hmm. Went to college in Maryland, and after graduation, I was commissioned in the Marine Corps.
Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, two brothers, two sisters. One's deceased, my older brother, Michael, and he was a great big brother. I was born, of course, just before Pearl Harbor, and my father went off to the Navy when I was about, well, less than a year old, and I didn't see him until I was five, so it was a kind of an interesting deprivation.
Do you remember what that was like?
I do remember him coming home, and I said, "Who's this strange man hugging my mother?" And but I think it has its downside, growing up without a dad in those early years. Mm-hmm. I suspect that, you know, they're really crucial first 5-6 years of a kid's life.
Was it what was it like to build a relationship with your dad after he came home?
I don't know. You know, fathers then were kind of standoffish. They didn't do much for their kids anyhow. And if they're, and my dad was a very loving, sweet man. But dads didn't, for the most part, go play ball, didn't ride bicycles with their kids, didn't teach them anything. They
well,
just
you had
worked.
A brother for that, right?
Just, yes. He was my big brother, and my teacher, my mentor, yes.
What year did you decide to enlist?
1959. I was 17 years old. I joined the Marine Corps Reserves. They promised me flight school, and they, in fact, sent me to flight school. That was just great fun. Once I got used to flying, never been in an airplane, had no idea how to fly an airplane.
What was the first time like?
I threw up, and I threw up the next six times. They sent me to a shrink. I say, are you really suited for this? Yes, I am. I just get car sick. Oh, okay. And they let me stay. And I went on and became a pretty damn good pilot. So, and actually, training, of course, is the best time because after that, people start shooting at you. That's not so much fun. But at least during the training period, it was quite good. A couple of interesting experiences. I tend to fall asleep easily. So on night solo flights, twice I fell asleep. And once I woke up in a screaming dive and woke up about 1,500 feet off the ground. And then the other time I was in a very shallow dive and recaptured that at about 500 feet. So I determined that maybe flying alone was not the best thing for me.
What made you wake up?
I don't know. I have an angel. I mean, I should have been dead so many times in the military and post-military. I'm blessed. I think when I was in Vietnam, I thought I had not a guardian angel, but somebody there looking after me, and I named him. I even gave him a name, Golden. Golden was on my side and kept me alive. I went over there with four pilots. We met in San Francisco on the same orders, and of those four, one was killed in action, one was wounded three times, one was mortally wounded, and I don't know if you guys have been hearing that term, but I think it's a true response to some matters of conscience, which so I've got a good friend, and he's morally wounded because of some of the things he did. He did them, and then on reflection, this is not right, but he still did them. And six Marines from my graduating class. Remember, small school, 120. Six of us went into the Marine Corps. One was killed in action. Four very early deaths, and I can't believe they weren't attributable to some kind of trauma. You know, they just shut down. And then there was me, who came out discouraged and depressed.
What has been helpful for you to cope with this?
Oh, about 5 years of therapy and prayer, forgiveness, asking for forgiveness. I think we shouldn't have been there. We cause all this death and destruction, and then we walk away from it. And now we're friends, we're trading partners. Why couldn't we be trading partners back in 1963?
You can hear this segment and the full interview with Timothy Kane and other StoryCorps segments on our StoryCorps page in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their three sanitized homes. More at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. Commentary now, and educators make a big impact on many of us, including commentator Peter Goodman.
Decades ago, a friend was telling me that his high school French teacher had not only taught him French, but held frank discussions of life that were even more valuable. I figured the teacher was probably retired, maybe doubting he ever did anything worth a damn. I suggested Dan write that teacher and thank him. And I realized I had a couple of letters to write, too. One to Blair Torrey, who coached hockey and taught English. He loved words and nature. He was gentle and thoughtful, but had starred on Princeton's football and hockey teams and been a Marine platoon instructor. Sophomore year, he had us write a theme each day for 6 weeks. It was intense. I still recall his human, personal comments. The day I got kicked out, when my gut was churning and it would be hours till my parents picked me up, Mr. Torrey suggested I skate around the hockey rink and shoot the puck against the boards. I skated and thought for hours. I also wrote law school professor Clark Bice. If you recall the tough-minded Professor Kingsfield terrorizing first-year law students in The Paper Chase, that's Bice. Most Harvard students believed the writer had based Kingsfield on Bice. Bice said he was preparing us for judges who'd be a hell of a lot tougher on us, which they were. He was shocked to hear that his gruff manner hurt people's feelings. By my third year, changes in his personal life had left him lonely. We'd see him going to his office at all hours to work, accompanied by a little black and white dog. In Robert Redford's 1994 film, Quiz Show, the protagonist, a young Harvard Law School graduate, feels awkward around a famous Columbia professor. They needed some Harvard bit to serve as an icebreaker. So whenever the protagonist visited, the older lawyer asked, "By the way, how's Clark Bice?" Somewhere, a woman watched that movie and then called Harvard to ask if there really was a Professor Bice there. During World War II, as an ambassador's daughter, she'd known an army lieutenant named Clark Bice in the Pacific and just wondered. They put her through to Clark. I can't say how well they'd known each other during the war, but by our 20th reunion in 2000, they were married. I started by saying letters to teachers you really appreciated might be welcome. Thinking about it, I'm just in awe of some of the wonderful folks who taught me. Others seemed jerks, and I gave them hell with youth's unwitting cruelty. They deserved better. 2 weeks ago, the tragic loss of Karen Trujillo, the ultimate teacher, was a vivid reminder. Thank someone who taught you while you still can.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. Environmental news now, and conservation groups say that land bridges can help migrating wildlife by preventing collisions on highways and rail lines. We get more from the New Mexico News Connection's Mark Richardson.
Wildlife migrations are part of the American West's lore and history, but many of those centuries-old passages are now obstructed by the trappings of modern civilization. There's a new optimism that renewed cooperation between states and federal agencies can identify and preserve seasonal migration routes in New Mexico and other states. At a virtual forum, people from public, private, and native conservation groups discussed the need for joint programs and renewed funding. Tracy Stone Manning with the National Wildlife Federation says despite each group's unique perspective, she believes it's an objective worth pursuing.
It's going to take intense work together and the right level of funding for all involved to make sure that we pass along these remarkable landscapes to the future.
Participants cited a 2018 federal order on cooperation between federal and state officials as the key to opening blocked routes and constructing passageways to allow migrating species to bypass hazards like highways and rail lines. Part of the optimism is driven by the Biden administration's renewed interest in protecting wildlife and endangered species. Leslie Allison with the Santa Fe-based Western Landowners Alliance says getting buy-in from property owners is essential for any agreement.
And we've got to be able to place sufficient value on the things that we want to conserve, that it's economically feasible to conserve them.
Julie Thorstenson with the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society notes tribal interests, which have been excluded from past agreements, must be part of any future solution.
Tribes own or influence the management of nearly 140 million acres, including more than 730,000 acres of lakes and reservoirs, 10,000 miles of streams and rivers, and 18 million acres of forests. These lands provide habitat for more than 500 species listed as threatened or endangered.
The session was part of a series of forums sponsored by the Pew Charitable Trusts, the National Wildlife Federation, and the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership aimed at developing sustainable policies to preserve wildlife migrations. Support for this report was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For New Mexico News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
A bill to prohibit the use of traps and poisons on New Mexico public lands was approved by the state legislature. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown has that story.
Roxy's Law, technically the Wildlife Conservation and Public Safety Act, passed the New Mexico House of Representatives last week. It would prohibit traps, snares, and poisons on public lands. Mary Catherine Ray, wildlife chair for the Sierra Club's Rio Grande chapter and a member of the Trap Free New Mexico Coalition, says it's taken several tries to get Roxy's Law through the legislature.
Roxy's Law is named for a dog who actually died in her owner's arms in a neck snare. And like all these devices, they're mindless. They don't make any decision on whether that is the correct animal or not.
There are exceptions in the law that allow for use of traps or poisons when it's necessary to protect public safety or for ecosystem management. But Ray says the bill would largely make New Mexico public lands trap-free. Trapping on private and tribal land would still be allowed. Bills similar to Roxy's Law have been introduced in the Roundhouse since 2017. Ray says in neighboring Arizona, such lethal traps are outlawed on public lands and statewide across Colorado. She says it's time New Mexico followed suit.
We talk about New Mexico tourism industry. Having these devices where people can get harmed by them puts us at a big disadvantage in our outdoor economy. So I think the time has come.
The legislation easily made it out of the Senate by a vote of 23-16, but passed in the House last week by the slimmest of margins, 35-34. Opponents said the bill should wait until it can be determined if new rule changes to wildlife management, including education and trapping prohibitions within a half mile of trailheads, are working. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
While New Mexico is taking action to prevent cruelty to animals, that's not the case in most of the Mountain West. In fact, Montana's newly elected Republican governor violated state hunting regulations when he trapped and shot a collared wolf near Yellowstone National Park in February, according to documents obtained by the Mountain West News Bureau. The Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports.
Yellowstone National Park is known for a lot of things. It's geysers, it's grizzly bears, and it's wolves. There are around 90 or so of the animals living within the park, and they're pretty famous.
People from all over the world come to Yellowstone specifically to see these wolves.
That's Jonathan Proctor. He's with the environmental nonprofit Defenders of Wildlife. He says the wolves are protected within Yellowstone, but if they wander outside of the park,
they can so easily be just killed.
That's because it's actually legal to hunt and trap wolves in neighboring states such as Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, as long as the wolf has stepped outside the park's boundaries. And that was the fate of a black male Yellowstone wolf known as 1155. He was born inside the park a few years ago, and he became one of the wolves biologists track using a radio collar. But recently, 1155 wandered outside of Yellowstone, likely in search of a new mate. Instead, though, he found a trap set by the state's governor, Greg Gianforte. Gianforte killed the wolf on February 15th on a private ranch about 10 miles north of the park. Perfectly legal, except Gianforte still got in trouble with state wildlife officials because he failed to take a required wolf trapping certification course before he killed the animal. John Sullivan is with the sportsman's group Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. He says this course is like taking driver's ed before you drive.
It's a really good thing to do so that the people who are engaging in this sport understand what they're doing, they're educated, they're safe.
And they learn how to trap wolves ethically and more humanely. Plus, it's required. Everyone who traps wolves has to take it. But Gianforte didn't. And after he killed his wolf, he was issued a written warning by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. The governor's spokesperson said Gianforte made a, quote, mistake, and he's since signed up for a class. But Sullivan said the governor should have known better.
It's difficult to fathom accidentally not taking that class.
That's because Sullivan says when you go to buy your wolf trapping licenses online, it clearly states that you need to register for the required class, too. Plus, Gianforte is an avid sportsman. In fact, he got into trouble 2 decades ago when he illegally shot a young elk.
He has been hunting and trapping in Montana for a long time, and I would be surprised to learn that he didn't know better than to finish that class, to complete that education. And we hope that he apologizes to the citizens of the state for, you know, circumventing the process that we all have to go through.
But Nick Jivak with the conservation nonprofit Montana Wildlife Federation takes a more measured approach. He says sure, Gianforte screwed up by not taking the class, but he also followed all the other rules.
It was within the bounds of the season, and the only violation in this case was lack of that course.
He says it's a teachable moment for Gianforte. Still, the governor's actions have drawn the ire of other prominent environmental organizations and animal protection groups, including the U.S. Humane Society. Amanda Wright says the governor got off easy.
He might have received a slap on the wrist in the form of a written warning, but this is really a slap in the face to the millions of people that, you know, come to his state to see these wolves.
She says an iconic and famous animal like the Yellowstone wolf deserves better. She also argues that wolf traps are inhumane.
They're extremely cruel.
She says they hold animals until they either injure themselves trying to escape or they're killed by hunters. New Mexico recently banned trapping on public lands there, but it's still legal across most of the Mountain West, including Montana, where the legislature is trying to expand trapping opportunities for wolves. In fact, Republicans are currently pushing a suite of bills that would drastically reduce the number of wolves in the state through hunting and trapping. And Gianforte? He's in charge of signing those bills into law. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Missoula, Montana.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau provided in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project is a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. Even though most 20th century battles took place overseas, war always hits home, and it hit rural New Mexico hard. In our final episode of this series, we learn about their experiences of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
On the morning of December 7, 1941, the people of the United States woke up to the news of an attack on the naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Americans immediately answered the call of service, both abroad and at home, as they have throughout history. In this episode, we talk about New Mexico's reaction and participation in World War II, and later, the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Lonnie Harper was born January 2, 1936. Lonnie describes the immediate impact the tragic event of Pearl Harbor had on not only the country, but locally in New Mexico.
Every farmer had 7 or 8 kids, and there was a lot of farmers, there was a lot of families. And what happened? World War II broke out. Now, I was 5 years old when Pearl Harbor came about, and that changed everything. My oldest brother, Jake, was already in Europe fighting the German Adolf Hitler, the Third Reich. But my number two brother was a junior, I think he was a junior in high school when it broke out. And, of course, he got permission from Dad, and within a month he had joined the Navy after Pearl Harbor. And all the boys of that age, they went. There was no question. They all joined the Army, Navy, or Air Force. Well, there wasn't no Air Force in those days. It was called the Army Air Corps. But that caused a lot of a mass exodus. Plus, farming was rough. It was you made maybe one crop that you could cut the wheat, you know, and put in the granary. The rest of the time, you're just dragging a machine over the land just to get enough seed to replant the next crop. But once out over 5 years is not a very good living. World War II, the munitions factories, the people building war machines, everybody went to California. The whole coast, West Coast. Factory after factory after factory. Men and women by the thousands had immediate jobs. And that country just, boy, they headed for California. So that was the, if I could say, the one changer. Mm-hmm. World War II and Japan, Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. changed everything.
Many of our interview subjects, like Lonnie, were just kids when these events were happening. Labeo Martinez and Bronson Springstead, who were also born in the 1930s, first heard the breaking news of war over the airwaves.
The only thing I remember, we had a battery-operated radio. And I think they were very rare. Not too many people had them. And the only thing I remember about the radio when I was a young boy, young down here, Mr. Sellers here had one in the store. And I went in there with a nickel or something to buy some bubble gum, and they were listening to the news when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
I remember that very vividly.
My granddad, Luke Kirk, had this old battery-operated radio, so we would listen to the news. It was all about the war. Batteries were not rechargeable, but they were big batteries. And this radio was about that long, about that tall, and it was real scrabbled. You'd have to really fine-tune it to get any kind of news. I don't even think Gallup had a news station at that time, but Albuquerque, we could get some from Albuquerque, and what was strange is we could get KRLD in Dallas. I don't know why.
Bronson's family, as well as many others, had to ration food, health supplies, and other items.
It was wartime. Things got pretty scarce. I mean, we were getting stamps for the government. I even found an issued green sugar stamp for me, because even the kids had to have these stamps, though, to buy sugar, to buy certain items, not canned goods, but sugar, flour, baking powder, that kind of stuff. You know, I had rheumatic fever in the first grade, and all the antibiotics were going to the war. You know, penicillin, it's a strep, so penicillin was a drug of choice, but all that was going to the war effort. So the doctors, all they would tell you is lots of fruit juice and fruits and vegetables and a lot of sunshine. Took a long time.
Jerry Saunders was born on August 28, 1935 in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Jerry talks about the difficulty of getting essential items that required ration coupons. Most kids would agree that nothing is more essential than candy.
During the war, when we lived with ration coupons, sugar and chocolate were two things it was hard to get. I can remember looking in the window at one of the little cafes on Main Street, this is Estancia, at the display of a few Hershey bars that they had obtained somehow. We were not allowed to have them because they took too many coupons. But oh, how we craved them when we couldn't have them. And chewing gum was the same way. There were times you wanted to kill for a stick of Juicy Fruit. You also needed coupons for shoes, gas, and other items that were considered vital to the war effort.
Jerry mentions that her dad was called to serve.
And then he was called up to active duty, because that would have been 40, I don't know whether it was 41 or 42. I could probably figure that out, but it would take a little digging. And because he had been in ROTC, and he was a lieutenant or something. And we went to Fort Sill in Oklahoma. He went first. And then, because of gas rationing, my mom and another wife, whose husband was also in the same group with my dad, they pooled their gas ration tickets and filled in the back of a big old Chevy four-door car, filled in the back of the seat up to the same level as the seat, made beds there, and they drove themselves and their kids to Fort Sill to join the dads there.
Gasoline as well as tires were needed for the war effort, as described in this next clip by Mary Ellen Warren. She was born on the Sierra Grande Ranch near Des Moines, New Mexico in 1927. She says her dad would not allow her to drive in order to protect their vehicle's tires.
My daddy wouldn't let me drive because we lived in the country and there were a lot of rocks. And he knew I'd hit a rock and ruin a tire, and tires you couldn't buy back during the war because you had to, you know, you were limited to how much, just like gasoline was rationed. Mm-hmm. You had these stamp books and you could buy so much gasoline. And he knew if I hit, I'd run the tire, so he didn't let me learn to drive.
For Mary Ellen, World War II was something she experienced very close to home. She recalls a time military planes in distress flew over the family ranch.
An airplane crashed on our ranch and set the prairie on fire, and it was a soldier in the plane. He was killed on impact. And when that happened, why, I guess there was another plane with him, and he circled the house until my mother was home alone with Grandpa and my little brother, and the airplane circled the house until he got their attention, and then she saw the fire. So she loaded up my grandpa and my little brother in the wagon. She had to catch the horses, harness them up, and then she got the cream cans full of water and the gunny sacks, and then went to where the fire was, worked to put it out. My older brother had just come home from the war.
She refers to her brother William E. Warren. He was MIA in Germany, and one day they got a letter from him saying he was in a POW camp.
That was in the summer of 45, and he had just come back from, and he couldn't help us because he was so crippled up from having his feet frozen in Germany. And he was a POW.
In contrast, there was a German POW camp just outside of Artesia, and the conditions there were drastically different, as described by Lucille Roland Wolf. Lucille was born in Artesia in 1925.
During World War II, they had a prisoner of war camp at Hegemann, which was outside of Artesia, not far. They trucked those prisoners in open trucks that had the big sides on them, you know, to the different fields where the farmers needed help. Because, of course, during the war, they didn't have any help. So the prisoners were put to work. The prisoners said they lived better than they did in Germany because they had little refrigerators and radios and the prisoners' quarters. And they got fed. When they'd be working and picking the cotton and harvesting the crops down, sometimes stop there at the store and they'd get cold drinks for all of the prisoners that'd been working out in the field. And they'd stop at the store and they'd get cold drinks for all the prisoners because they had to drive on to Artesia, past Artesia to Hegemann.
As the war efforts continued, programs like the Civilian Conservation Corps, or the CCC, would help young men find work and also get them ready to serve in the Army. Kay Bird was born on April 7, 1928 in Savannah, Georgia. Her family would later move to Elephant Butte, New Mexico. Kay talks about a CCC camp that was located in Elephant Butte.
You know, those CCC camps were just wonderful, what they did. They took mostly boys from the East who had hardly ever been out, even outside, you know. They lived in tenements and places, and they put them to work. They did a lot of work up at Elephant Butte Dam and all kinds of work, and they became strong and healthy. They were a sickly, frail bunch when they got there, and it's a good thing they did, because the next thing they had to do was fight a war.
Larry Gordon was born in 1926 in Oklahoma and moved to New Mexico in 1930. He met his wife while attending the University of New Mexico. He served in the Navy in the 40s, and his wife served in the Marine Corps, as he proudly recalls.
She went away and became an officer in the Marine Corps, and she wasn't gone very long for that. She was one of those so-called 90-day wonders. And about a year after she returned, we married.
Was that unusual at that time for a woman to go into the military?
Yeah.
Okay.
She was in the first Marine women's class following following World War II, which it was.
But it was the first one ever.
It was the first one.
Wow.
And there was about 60-some started in it, and only about, as I recall, 16 maybe completed the rather rigorous requirements.
Claude Leyendecker attended college at New Mexico A&M, or present-day New Mexico State University, in the early stages of World War II.
I started at New Mexico A&M in the summer of 1942. It was the summer semester, I remember, and that was when World War II was beginning various phases. College had an ROTC program. It took I can't remember, 2, 3, or 4 years to make it through their program, and the war was now. A bunch of farm boys and ranch boys that I knew joined the active services that were facing the enemy at that time. I wasn't doing too good in college, that's for sure. So I joined what was called then the Air Corps. Made it sound a little stronger and a little larger. They changed the name of the United States Air Force.
Monty Shriver was born in El Dorado on September 28, 1934, and his family moved to Aztec in 1937. While there, they had blackout drills to simulate a possible attack from Japan.
But I know we had blackouts. They would practice a blackout in Aztec.
Okay.
And you could hear the plane might fly over, and you know, but the lights, of course, all our lights are out. That's a big thing, to have blackouts.
Okay.
Practice a blackout.
He later joined the ROTC program while in college. This was during a new conflict, the Korean War, which lasted between 1950 and 1953.
ROTC, that's where a land-grant university, it used to be, because of the Morrill Act, it was required for the first 2 years to be in ROTC. Of course, the Korean War was on, and you got a deferment. So we all wanted to be in the first 2 years. I mean, you know, you'd be deferred. And then the last 2 years, I was in Air Force, ROTC, you wanted to get into advance, because then you, at that time everyone was getting drafted. We said, well, if we're going to serve, we might as well go in as officers.
Immediately following the Korean War, the Vietnam War also broke out. The United States got involved in the conflict in the mid-60s. David Duran, who was born in the Ambulo-Dixon area, describes the draft of 1969.
They drafted so many people in August of 1969 because the draft was going to end. They were going to go to the lottery where they'd pick ping pong balls with numbers on them and associate that with a name. There were so many people drafted that there wasn't enough room for them in Fort Bliss. They were sleeping on the floor in the halls. And there were so many kids there that couldn't even speak English. A lot of Hawaiians were not literate in English that they had drafted. A lot of kids from Puerto Rico who could only speak Spanish were there with us. It was a huge draft. I imagine most boot camps in the country were full of people. The military thought that was the end of their ability to get people into the service. And then I ended up going to Fort Bragg for a year. The reason why I think there was a delay in my orders from boot camp to find out where I was going to go is because I was going to be assigned to a top secret area of the military. So when I finally got to Fort Bragg, my orders weren't even there. I mean, my paperwork wasn't there. It was delayed. They were trying to get a top secret clearance for me, which means the FBI had to go around and do a bunch of research on me, I suppose.
According to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, the estimated number of veterans in the state of New Mexico as of 2017 is 158,994. That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in.
That's KRWG News this week. If you ever miss an episode, no worries. We have you covered. You'll find the program under the local radio section at krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.